Alrighty, g'day everybody. My name's Glenn Hill.
And I'm Jacob Meyer.
And welcome to another episode of Technical Tennis Podcast.
So today, we want to talk about this, well, obviously interesting conversation of tennis stats that really matter.
Yeah, well, come on, Jacob. All of our conversations are interesting.
I mean, clearly.
Obviously, duh.
You floated this idea to me, and my immediate question was, well, what tennis stats exactly do matter? And so we decided to just record instead.
Yeah, so we're kind of making this up as we go along a little bit. So this isn't something where we have discussed it beforehand and come to a consensus. We're literally going to kind of hash this out live as we go.
To be fair, I'm sure like in the last 10 years, we've complained about stats and the
yes.
way people interpret stats plenty.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And that's really, I think, where this conversation starts for me and why I suggested it was because it deeply bothers me the way that we do stats in tennis, and with the resources that we have available now, why we still are presenting the same types of statistics that we were 10, 15, 20, 30 years ago is just beyond me.
Yeah.
I mean, there's been no change. There's been no evolution. And this is important because statistics are how we have a very meaningful and scientific way to genuinely improve tactics and strategy, right? And prove that changes in tactics and strategy are successful beyond the actual scoreline.
Well, of course, that all depends on how you interpret them. And yeah, I think using statistics to demonstrate improvement is really important at all different kinds of levels. I remember when I was evolving from, say, like a 4.5 level player to a 5.0, there's some time in there, I think some considerable time, when you feel like you're playing better, but you're not just obviously beating significantly better players yet.
Right. And
so,
statistics would be one way to get some measurable feedback, but this is the thing to me that's far more important, is that if we take good statistics can help us improve significantly in very short periods of time.
During that time. Not just prove that you've improved,
but they can actually
help you along the process.
Yeah, no, actually, statistics can and should be a driving force, especially when you talk about players who have already developed their game fairly completely to the degree, I mean, look, Novak Djokovic, great player. I wouldn't call him a complete player in the sense that his net game is not quite where I would like to see it be, or doesn't match up to people who specialize in that area, let's say. But, I mean, his game's not going to change in any really significant way. We could say the same thing about, you know, most of the guys in the Pro Tour, right? They're at a very stable place.
Absolutely.
And for somebody in that situation where their technique isn't going to go through any major evolution, statistics can drive us to change the way we play the sport without changing our technique. And a classic example of this, and a recent example of this, would be Roger Federer's quote-unquote new and improved backhand, which is the same stroke from a technical standpoint, but the if we look at tactically and strategically what he's doing with that shot has changed utterly. That's something that we could actually have helped him reach the decision to change to that more aggressive backhand years ago, a decade ago, with the good use of good statistics.
A lot faster, yeah.
Right, because if you can sit there and show somebody, look, if you drive the backhand and attack at cross court instead of hitting the slice, you will win 27% more points just making that number up. Well, then at that point, it becomes a matter of, do I want to win more slams or not? Because 27% more points is like a crazily significant number.
Yeah, that's huge.
Within that particular pattern, and you'd have to be an idiot not to adopt that change, right? So,
or you'd have to be one of the most stubborn men in the world, which those top tennis players often are.
Sure, absolutely. So what we can do is if we take good, really good statistics, those good statistics can actually drive a deeper understanding of the sport, and particularly for individuals, they can drive a deeper understanding of what works for you and what doesn't work. Where are the holes in your current decision-making processes and patterns that need to change in order for you to get a better outcome? And the way we take stats in tennis right now accomplishes virtually none of that.
Virtually none of that. So this is obviously going to evolve into a conversation about much different aspects, or much, not different, but much deeper aspects of both coaching and personal development. But before we get there, let's talk about the stats that we actually collect and what do they actually do. So like if I watch a match on TV, what stats do I have access to?
Right. Well, it's not just TV. I mean, and this is the thing that kills me, is with the internet and the data that we know they have access to now, as far as what we can pull out of, you know, ShotSpot, blah, 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 blah. There's just an absurd amount of information. And this becomes part of the challenge, right? I mean, I don't want to sit here and make it sound like, oh my God, the people that are responsible for the data for the ATP tour are idiots. It just comes down to a fact of there's so much information, and being able to pass that down and understand what should be presented is hard. And I think most tennis coaches can't do a good job of that. So why should we expect, you know, a data analyst for IBM to know what to pull out from a tennis match?
Yeah, let's do a quick side note on ShotSpot here, because I've got some familiarity with that system. The ShotSpot system that they use for the challenge system, right? When you're at a ATP tournament and whenever they challenge a call, that system is collecting basically constant data on where the ball is at all times. So if you want to know, say, what's the average height of one of the players' kick serve, like the bounce on the kick serve, or what's the height of his toss, then you can do that. But literally someone has to sit there and program into this massively complicated system how to figure that out. So it's essentially almost infinite data that's being collected. And yes. So what we see is a combination of what the programmers think, well, this makes sense to capture, what historically has been captured, what perhaps the producers have asked for, and what, you know, whoever else has some authority, whether it's Brad Gilbert or Patrick McEnroe or whoever is in the broadcaster booth saying, hey, you know, can you guys get X, Y, and Z? I mean, the Hawkeye is still a company that actually does this stuff. So the Hawkeye guys are just responding to that. And it's not like they have a team of 20 people to sit there and, you know, write new code in the middle of a tournament to get a really interesting, you know, piece of information out.
Right.
But that's a huge, huge deal. And this is, I think this brings us to where we are, say, as tennis coaches, just watching a match live. We can write down whatever stats we want and estimate things in person and just, you know, write things down on a sheet of paper like we still do old school a lot of the time. But there's this really big question of, well, what is it that we should be looking at? I mean, traditionally, when we look at the stats that are readily available, like if I go on the ATP app, I don't even have access to aces, but we used to see aces all the time.
Right. And you can see that. You can see aces on, for example, the ATP website, but not on the app.
Correct.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which has been an interesting choice as well. But, you know, you see like break points saved, you know, the really simple stuff. You see total points won, which is actually really helpful and ironically didn't used to be collected once upon a time.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think historically they've spent a lot of time collecting unforced errors, forced errors, backhand unforced errors, things like that.
Right. And here's the problem to me is, I mean, largely what they collect is outcomes, and they give us statistics that are obvious. Like they give us the things that are like no brainers. So, okay, break points saved, right? I mean, if we look at the match yesterday between Thiem and Murray, you know, I can look at the stats for this match, and this tells me how many aces and double faults each player hit, their first serve percentage, their first serve points won, second serve points won, you know, break point save, blah, 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 right? So some of these are really obvious stuff, and some of it's utterly useless. So the number of aces a player hits, like let's just start there. The number of aces a player hits, what does that do for us as viewers or students of the game to know that Thiem hit six aces and Murray hit one ace? It's a meaningless statistic because in tennis, if I hit a wide serve that my opponent doesn't touch, that counts as an ace and that gets recorded. If I hit a wide serve that my opponent tips off the end of his racket and flies into the stands, I win the same number of points, right?
Yeah.
And it has the same value to me as a player, and has the same impact on the outcome of the match, but we record one in its own category and not the other. And when we look at statistics, one of the big things to me is meaningful statistics should help me become better or help me help somebody become better. If I look at the statistics for a match, I should be able to see patterns that let me say to somebody, if you do X, then you will have a better outcome. But if I look at the statistics, again, coming back to the Team Murray match, right? First serve percentage. Great. So we know that Team had a horrible first serve. By the way, he played 49% first serves and won the match. Just want to pause for 1 second and acknowledge that fact. So that's crazy, right? But what am I going to say to Team off of that? Obviously, he needs to go and work on his first serve percentage. But how does that really help us? Am I going to tell him, hey, go make more first serves? Awesome. Well, right? And then if I look at first serve percents won. So Team won 71% of his first serves. That's great. And Murray won 54. So what's my take on for Murray out of that match? Am I going to tell him, well, Murray, you only won 54% of your first serves yesterday. Next time I want you to go out and I want you to win more points on your first serve.
Yeah, he wasn't trying to do that, though. You know, he thought that 54% would have been just the right number.
Wow, come on. Nobody wants 54% one of their first serve. But you understand what I'm saying, right? Like, I mean, like, I can't give a player meaningful feedback on this. I can just say, hey, go be better. And these don't – none of these statistics reveal any patterns about the match. They don't reveal any of the tactics or strategy, the impact of any of these things. They just give us numbers that are outcomes. And what we really want out of statistics is the things that lead to the outcomes and the things that affect the outcomes.
I think it's easy to tell people, like, well, you want to serve maybe 70% first serves. Well, I mean, Verdasco was doing that, but he wasn't winning points off his first serve. He wasn't getting free points off his first serve, and he was in a battle every time the ball went in the court.
Right.
You know, there were times when he was serving over 80%. I mean, there were times where I think he was the leader in terms of first serve percentage, which was just another sort of roundabout way of saying that he was maybe at the bottom of the pack in terms of confidence in his second serve.
That's an interesting observation, but probably an accurate one.
Yeah. So,
or it could also just be bad coaching. Somebody's telling him, hey, go out there and make more first serves because you're going to do better. And this is where it becomes interesting because obviously there's that trade-off, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think that at the end of the day, it's not just a single shot that is winning for you on the tennis court anymore. You have to put things together in the big picture. So if you have some unbelievable shot that's simply unreturnable, like Ivo Karlovic's first serve, then okay, great. If you can hit aces 80% of the time, you're going to hold serve. But even Karlovic can't do that. So I don't think that really applies to any of us.
No.
And so what we actually have to do is put things together in a way that gives us the definitive opportunity to actually win points the way that we want to.
And this is where it gets very complicated because we still don't have, I think, a perfect or even a close to a perfect understanding of tennis and how to play tennis in the best way possible. And it's such an infinitely variable game. There's so many things that go into any given point, let alone an entire match, that distilling it down is exceedingly difficult. But here are some things that we do know. So let's come back to this idea of serving for a moment, and let's build on this. If we can accept that recording aces is a terrible measure of serving or serving performance, then the next question, I mean, we could be those people that complain or we could solve the problem, right? So if the problem is that measuring aces and double faults and first serve percentage is poor, then how do we do things well? Well, let's start to look at the impact that different types of serves have on the outcome of a match, because ultimately the goal is I want to play each point in a way that maximizes my chances of winning that specific point. And if I can do a good job of that, then I'm going to win a lot of points and certainly enough to win matches. So if I looked at serving, how can I record some things related to the serve that actually are really down the line impactful? If we look at directional serving, which they do a good job of at the slams these days with the shot track, you know, we can tell how many serves a player hits in a particular point position.
And I think we have Craig O'Shaughnessy to thank for that.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, Craig's done some great work, and he's done some great statistical work as well regarding, you know, like the impact For example, I remember reading a great one he did a while back about the impact that it has on Federer if he gets to hit a forehand as his first ball after the serve as the back end. There's a huge split in his win percentage. But let's focus on serving again for a moment. So what they do a good job of now at the slams, and only at the slams really, is that you can get statistics on where a player has hit their serves and even how many points they win overall. What they don't do is kind of put all this together. So let's take the wide serve, for example, right? If I wanted to be able to take statistics related to serving in a way that lets me actually improve a player's game or improve their margins, a better way to track serving would be to track, let's say on first serves, the number of attempts wide they make, the number that they actually get in the court when they serve wide, and then two more statistics I think that are very important here. One would be how many of those serves come back in play. And secondly, how many of those serves, when we serve out wide, do we actually win the point on? And from that, I can get some very interesting stuff, right? So I can, for example, understand for every attempt at a wide serve I make on the deuce court on a first serve, what are my chances of winning the point? Not just when they go win, but just overall. Because, look, if I win a point 100% of the time, if I win the point every single time I hit the wide serve, but I only make it one-third of the time, then that's not a very good strategy, right? Right. So that way I can – and if I do this for all three serve locations, let's say if we go wide on the deuce court, body on the deuce court, and tee on the deuce court, and I can start to get my over-under on. If I hit – if I attempt a tee serve, then my chances of winning the point are, let's just say, 62%. If I attempt the body serve, that might be, you know, 68%. If I attempt the wide serve, it might be 54%, right? And now I can start to build a serving strategy in the deuce court based on those numbers and understand – on a big point where it is that I really want to serve to increase my margins and increase my chance of winning that point. So that's a kind of a deeper way of looking at serving. Okay.
To me, I like that. Well, the I don't really have pet peeves. I mean, you know me, I don't really get upset about a lot of stuff, but theoretically my pet peeve would be when we do things like we count aces, but we don't count unreturnable serves. So we make this insignificant difference between a ball that's tipped but has no chance of coming into the court and a ball that's missed by a millimeter. Like, that's just not helpful for me. I mean, I want to see what the unreturnables are, and I want to see how many serves that maybe a guy gets a full racket on but that just don't come back into the court at all. I mean, because you know me, like, I'm not a big guy and I'm not a big server, but I do get free points on my serve a lot. Guys make good contact with them. It's more of like a Greg Maddux pitching style where they're going to make contact, but they're going to make a lot of errors.
Well, to me, I mean, the classic example of this would be Pat Rafter, right, whose serve wasn't big by any stretch of the imagination. He counted it as a win if he could get his opponent to hit the ball, say, 2 inches off center. He wasn't worried about acing people a lot of the time. He wasn't even worried about the serve not coming back. His philosophy, well, look, if I can get a guy to actually make contact with the ball two inches outside the center of the string bed,
then that's perfect.
Then his control's gone, and I'm going to get the first volley that I want. And that's what he cared about, you know. So, yeah, I mean, that's a much deeper way of looking at it. And this is where I think we start to get into this territory of, well, how deep down this rabbit hole do we really want to go? Because the next thing that I think is important for a player, if I'm looking at an individual and I'm saying, look, let's work on your serving strategies and figure out the best way for you to play tennis, the next thing that we would ask is, well, what's your biggest strength off the next ball? If you take the serve out of the picture for a moment, what shot do you want to be hitting as your first ball of a rally? Right. Do you want to be hitting a forehand? Do you want to be hitting a backhand? Or you know, maybe for Misha Zverev, if you want to be hitting a volley. But take most players. Let's just ignore serve volleying for a moment because it's a little bit of a different animal. Same concepts apply, but just differently. So you make that decision. Do I want to be hitting a forehand or do I want to be hitting a backhand? And for the vast majority of people, it's a forehand. That's what you want. So Federer, I think, would be a great example of somebody who was ahead of the curve compared to most players. And I'm not saying he was the first, but certainly he was very consistent about this throughout his career and has been, understanding how much he wants to hit forehands. And playing and constructing points, like serving specifically with getting forehands as the first ball in mind. Because he has, a really good sense, or has always had a really good sense of, look, if I hit a forehand, I'm probably winning the point. And if I hit a backhand, I may or may not win the point. And maybe he didn't, you know, have the numbers hashed out, where somebody sat down and actually did the stats for him, and he knew exactly what those margins were.
No chance, yeah.
Yeah, but I think he just intuitively had a very good understanding of that, and also intuitively really started to put the pieces together in terms of, if I serve here, then this is probably coming back. And if I serve here, then this is probably coming back. And this is one of the reasons why, and I actually wrote an article about this, it was, goodness gracious, it'd be about 2 or 3 years ago now, about how Federer uses the wide serve on the deuce court specifically in order to get a forehand for the first ball. And how he uses that to set that up. And this is why when you watch him play, traditionally, he will hit about 50% of his first serves on the deuce court wide. Right? Of the three options, about 50% wide.
That, I think it's up to like 70 now.
Oh God, is it really that high?
Yeah, that's what Oshansi has. It just keeps going because it keeps going more and more. I mean, the more, and this is, I think, part of the point that you made earlier. The more that we get better statistics, and I guarantee you that Federer and his team are looking at Oshansi's work.
Oh, okay? Absolutely.
The more that we get better statistics, it is affecting even the guy with 18 Grand Slams who's going down as the greatest player of all time. So if he's going to adapt to it, I mean, just imagine the impact that it has with lesser players. And with, you know, me back when I was 20, like if I had known that stuff, man, I would have jumped levels like so much faster. I mean, it's almost like I feel bad for myself right now.
Yeah. No, I mean, I feel bad for you too right now.
Oh, come on.
I'm just kidding. No, but so this is really, we can keep building on this, right? So we can then, if we really want to get fancy, you say, well, great. So let's say I track when I hit each of these serves. If I hit a wide serve on the deuce court, where does the ball come back? If I hit a body serve on the deuce court, where does the ball tend to come back? And understand, we're talking percentages here. We're talking statistics. We're talking odds. There's no guarantees, right? I can hit this wide serve on the deuce court, and let's say I get the ball back cross court 75% of the time. Well, that still means, you know, a quarter of the time the return's going to go somewhere else. We just have to understand that we're playing odds. And if we play odds and we buy into that idea, then, you know, in the long run, things are probably going to work out very well for us. And this is something that's come to the fore in a lot of other sports. I think probably the most notable one would be baseball, because they're so statistics nuts in baseball. I mean, they have been for a long, long time. Mm-hmm. Baseball, people in baseball obsess over statistics. And for those of you who have seen Moneyball, you understand that story. But the book is actually very interesting, because obviously you see the movie and it's got Brad Pitt and Jonah, and, you know, it's funny and it's entertaining and it's engaging and it's a great narrative. The book is actually significantly more interesting in a sense, because there's people behind those layers who actually were the driving force for all of this. And the guy who originally really started tackling this idea of, hey, everybody in baseball is doing statistics wrong and you're valuing players wrong, literally was trying to get this idea across to anybody in Major League Baseball for over a decade. And everyone ignored him. Well, and just continued to do things the way they were doing. And he's trying, like, he's just banging on the door saying, somebody, please listen. And then finally, somebody did, and it literally changed the way they looked.
It changed everything. Yeah.
And I think tennis is approaching, and we don't have like any one particular individual who's in the same shoes, but we're approaching that kind of a crossroads, I think, where we're about to have enough data that somebody's going to start to put the pieces together in a way that can change the way we look at the sport. I mean, I think that we're already doing the thinking on it. It's just getting access to all of that, all of the data, all the information.
Well, I want to interrupt here, because there's a rabbit hole to go down with Moneyball, of course, with some really interesting stuff. But I want to draw a distinction. There's a difference between working to improve an individual skill set and doing the things that turned into the Moneyball movie and the Moneyball book, okay? Because in Moneyball, you're really looking at a corporation being like a baseball team, right? Deciding that they're valuing players incorrectly. and finding value in different ways.
Well, but it goes a little beyond that, obviously. I mean, it also changes the strategy.
It goes way beyond that. It changes their strategy for how to build a team. So they're literally deciding what to do with their players differently. But in tennis, I think that we have this really great structure where you're one-on-one and you win or you lose. So, you know, we don't have to worry about valuing players as much because essentially everyone plays a full schedule and it's a question of, well, who wins the most, right? But what we can do is we can take, I mean, what I think is really happening in tennis is we're using the same sort of theoretical understanding to really drive individual performance.
Yeah, no, absolutely. That's exactly what I'm talking about, is finding ways to improve your margins, right? Is taking this idea of, if I do this, if I do A instead of B, I get two options in front of me. And on a given serve, like let's say it's you know, where that's 5-6 in the third set and it's deuce and I've got to win this point. Having an understanding, if I hit the ball wide here as my serve, and get a forehand as my first ball, I have, let's say, a 70% chance of winning the point. Whereas if I go at the tee and I get a backhand, I have a 45% chance of winning the point. And understanding the importance of those decisions and driving better choices as a result of that. If I get a forehand here, if I take it, you know, down the line versus cross court, you know, what's my split? I don't think players are going to necessarily know, most players aren't going to necessarily know the exact numbers at a given moment. But they should understand the trends, and they should understand how to make better choices as a result of the statistical outcomes.
Yeah, I mean, there's too many stats, even, you know, whether it's baseball, basketball, you know, any of the team sports, there's too many stats for players to know what they are in real time when they're going on. They have to look at an analysis sheet afterwards.
Well, for most players, it's crazy because this is an interesting – one of the things that really got me thinking about this a lot several years ago was actually an article – related to basketball, and I'm trying to remember who it was, but the guy was a defensive monster, and he actually would memorize out, they would bring him the stats before the game, like let's say he's going to go out there and guard Kobe, and he would memorize where, like in each, he had the whole kind of forecourt defensively broken up into little areas. And he knew Kobe's shot percentage from every single spot on the court, every little zone. And his goal to go out there wasn't to go out there and shut Kobe down so Kobe wouldn't score at all, right? Yeah. It was, look, if we can take Kobe and instead of having a 35-point game, Kobe has a 25-point game, that's a win. And so he would drive Kobe and actually let him shoot from areas that where his percentages were lower. Mm-hmm. And kind of limit him that way. So instead of letting him shoot from a place where he would make 42% of his shots, he'd let him shoot from a place where he'd make 37% or 35%. And basically control the percentages that way and just have him miss, you know, four or five more shots in an entire game, and that was considered a win.
I want to
say, operating at that level, obviously.
I want to say that was Carlos Boozer, but I know the article that you're talking about.
Yeah.
I could be wrong about Boozer there. But, yeah, I mean – There's a difference between being able to process that. Like I work with some players who can process really large amounts of information and make tactical decisions in game, which is an awesome, awesome quality. I mean, that one takes a while to teach because it requires like a pretty good brain. But there's a difference between that and then actually knowing, you know, halfway through my second set, okay, well, how long have like all the points lasted on serve versus how long have the points lasted on his serve versus how many times am I getting my serve plus one forehand versus, you know, I mean, there's
I think knowing that in the middle of your game is not, I think if you are knowing those numbers, then you're doing something wrong. You're focusing on the wrong things, you know,
but you should know
what the trends are. The point is driving kind of larger scale behavior here. It's not always about, look, what am I going to do on this specific point? It's what are my trends? What do I need to be focusing on? What are the decisions that I need to be making as a whole? And having an understanding of those trends.
So when we talk about driving trends and we talk about stats, I mean, obviously we spent some time on aces. I don't want to sit here and go through, man, this is the problem with collecting forced errors on the backhand side. And this is the problem with forehand. You know, I don't want to go through every little thing that they collect, right? What I want to know is, what are the stats that you really look at, generally speaking, right? Or how do you think about determining which stats to look at for a given player? Like, when I think about me, I want to get better. What do I need to look at in order to drive my trends in the right direction?
Well, so now we're getting into a very interesting question, because are we talking about what stats do I look at that the ATP records, or what stats do I record when I want to figure out how to play
better? I'm saying, what do you record? Like, I'll tell you, you know, like I have a guy with got some bad movement patterns. So every time he does a certain thing where he has this bad movement pattern, I jot it down, and I can come to him afterwards and say, hey, you did that thing 13 times. And we know that that's bad, right? Or we know that basically he used to do it 35 times. So we've gone from 35, you know, incrementally down to 13. We're going in the right direction, but we have to keep track of it.
Sure.
Are the things that are really important to track in order to drive my trends positively?
That's a really good question. And it varies from player to player. And when I start looking at statistics for a given player, the first thing I'm going to do is kind of map out a match. And when I talk about mapping out a match, this is a little bit painstaking, but I'll sit down, watch an entire match, and record every error and winner for the entire match. And this is the starting point, right? So I'll basically draw out a picture of a court, and then I'm going to, for every single winner and error in the entire match for that particular player, I'm going to mark on that picture of the court where they were standing when they hit the shot and what direction the ball was going in. And let's say it's forehands, I'll do like a little circle. And if the circle is open, as in it's not shaded in, it's just a circle, that marks an error. And if it's shaded in, that would mark a winner. And so I'm going to draw that little circle where they were making contact with the ball, and an arrow pointing in the direction they were trying to hit it.
Okay.
And I'm going to move on. And so I've got, let's say, circles for forehands and triangles for backhands, and then squares for volleys. And I'm going to map out the entire match that way and just look for trends. Because if we've got a particular place or a particular shot they keep making errors on, let's just say that they keep trying to hit backhands down the line from behind the baseline, and that's a constant source of error, then that's a place to start. Right? What I'm really looking for is just identifying any gross decisional errors where you keep making this choice and it keeps resulting in an error. And let's make that choice less. Or let's find a different, better choice that improves our odds. And that's where I'm going to start. And then obviously after that, we can start to get more and more sophisticated. But really, when I do that, that's the first thing I'm going to do if I start working with a player, is do that for multiple matches so I can figure out where their bread is buttered. You know, like which side are you hitting more winners off of, and which side are you making more errors off of, and where in the court are you standing when you do these things? And that'll give me an understanding of what's driving their game and limiting their game right now. And from there, we can start to figure out strategies to reduce those number of errors and increase the number of winners and generally improve the dynamic with which we're playing the match.
I got to tell you, that's a pretty intense place to start. That's like a full-blown analysis, okay?
Well, it's not a full-blown analysis. It's a full-blown analysis of winners and errors. I mean, we're only recording those things.
I'm not saying it's a perfect analysis of everything that's out there.
No, but it is pretty deep. I mean, it's time-consuming is really what it is. Because you don't
I could count, I think, the number of times that I've done that in my life.
Yeah, I don't do it for every match. I mean, let's not be crazy. I mean, what it is for me is I'll do that for two or three matches, and that's how I start. Right? That's how I start getting an understanding of the decisions that somebody's making. Because it's one thing, you know, we all come with our own biases. We all come with our own ideas and preconceived notions. And there's that whole idea of confirmation bias. A lot of times we see what we expect to see. And I don't want to watch a match and have a player come off the court and say, yeah, I don't think you did enough with your forehand, or you did this, you did that, or you needed to do more of this. And maybe that's true and maybe it's not. And I think at this point I probably make a pretty good first judgment of that. But
yes,
I do want to have a really good understanding of, look, these are the numbers. Like this, you made 8 errors from this spot in the court hitting the same shot. Look for these themes. And I think that's a really important starting point.
I'll tell you that this is another one of those places where I've been doing this for a long time. I think that O'Shaughnessy made some things explicit. And what I really like is that I get to send his articles along with your articles to other players and have them read stuff so they can read some big time data from O'Shaughnessy, then some specific analysis and pattern recognition stuff from Tactical Tennis. And then they've learned something at the end of, you know, an hour that traditionally would have taken them months to figure out with a coach actually working with them. And so when I'm looking at matches, one of the first things that I look at right now is how long are the points and what are you trying to do with the first two balls? And I want to match up what a player's sort of style and strengths are with those very basic statistics. So for instance, I've had guys who are serve and volley players and find themselves grinding out points.
Right.
This is like a bad combination, right?
that's generally not going to end so well.
And so, but sometimes, I mean, they're winning matches because they're good players, right? But if you want to play your best tennis, you have to get those things to line up regularly. And right. Likewise, I had a college guy a couple of years ago who was a superior athlete. And when he extended points, I mean, he just smothered you. It was like playing Rafa. You felt like you could not get a ball by him. He was right. So fast and he was so balanced on both sides where he didn't seem to have a weakness in the forehand or in the backhand that it really hurt people. But when we looked at his matches, it was like, dude, you're playing 60% of your points are two shots, three shots or less. You know, and that's not necessarily a bad thing. Like for the serve and volleyer, that's perfect.
Right.
But for the guy who feels really comfortable and tends to win the majority of his points in long extended rallies, we were saying, you know, on your service games, if you win a point quickly, fine. But on his service games, stop going down the line. Stop hitting the cross-court angles that are really sharp angles. Play more up the middle, and let's get it into your comfort zone.
Right.
And so, I mean, that's obvious. I know that's really, really simple, but essentially, I want to know what you think about that, because that's kind of where I start to really open the conversation with players, and then we start breaking down specific patterns like, okay, what happens if I hit a kicker up the tee instead of serving out wide? How's that point going to develop? When would I do that? Why would I do that? What am I looking for? And then obviously, when is that a good idea and a bad idea?
Right. So, and that's why I start where I do, because I want to get a bigger picture map of where does this player make errors and where do they hit winners? And then from there, because ultimately at the end of the day, I don't care how long the rally is. I mean, assuming that somebody's physically able to also do long rallies if need be, but I don't care how long the rally is. I care, what we really care about is, do I get the shot that's going to let me win the point and make you lose the point? And so to really do that, I need to understand, not just from my idea of watching you play and say, well, I think that, you know, your forehand's your biggest weapon. Let's get data on it. And let's understand, yes, your forehand is your biggest weapon, but really actually only from this particular area. And this is the area where you really have an impact and win points. So I get that map first, and then everything else comes down to let's find a way to drive play so you get the shot that you hit winners on. And when you get the shot that you normally traditionally hit the error on, we make a better choice and give us a chance to get to the point where you get the shot that you hit the winner on. And we'll do that for a while. And then we start to look at serving patterns and these other things to create those positive opportunities. But do that, and after we've done that, you play more matches, and then do another little bit random statistical analysis and come back to that original map and see, is it changing? You know, am I doing something different now? Now that you're not trying to take backhands down the line from 2 feet behind the baseline, in your own backhand corner, what happens now? How do the numbers skew? Maybe now we actually get to see something new where it's now I'm actually, when you wait and you don't hit that shot and you take that deep cross court, eventually maybe you get a short backhand and you actually are nails on the short backhand. And we didn't even know that because you weren't even getting short backhands before.
Right.
And now that's another layer that we can start to incorporate. And I think probably we should wind up there before we bore people to tears with all the statistics.
No, I think that's always a safe place to start. The last thing that I'll add is that I had a player who I tried to get to do that. I was coaching him from like distance, right, from the other side of the country, and saying, hey, you know, I can't tell you for sure what's happening in your game because it's been too long since I've actually seen you. And I get the feeling that what you think is happening probably isn't fully accurate. So film your match and let's go over it. And we're going to take the stats just like basically the same way that you just went over. And then we're going to talk about it. And for whatever reason, he basically refused to do it. I mean, this was a couple years ago, so cameras were harder to come by. Couldn't find a place to put the camera. It was indoors or something, you know, whatever, blah, blah, blah. So what we did then was we almost had to work backwards, which was a slower process. But it was, okay, structure your game like this. Make these things happen. And then if you find yourself where, say, you're getting that short backhand and you're going down the line because that's what you want to do, and you play two or three matches, and guess what? You're not winning those points and you're making errors on that short backhand down the line. I think you just figured out that it's not as good as you think it is. It's sort of a cheap way to take statistics, but to force yourself into that place where you essentially are testing the shots that you think are really good.
Right.
And it allowed him to at least identify his strengths and weaknesses. And so he rethought then what his strengths and what his weaknesses were. And then eventually now, since then, I've actually got him to sit down and do real stats, which was much more powerful for him and way to go.
Yeah.
But at least he was able to make a jump in his learning. And so his level was able to go up. I mean, the guy's gone up from like a 4-0 to a 5-0 player.
Right.
So it's not insignificant.
Yeah, and the only problem that I have with that isn't the methodology, it's just the people side of it, which is...
Oh, it's so hard to do.
Well, it's more that people... I can put two people and have them play exactly the same match, point for point, shot for shot, and talk about it with them afterwards, and they'll have two completely different interpretations of what happened.
Oh, yeah,
and
totally.
One of them might say, yeah, my short backhand down the line was nails. I crushed that ball. It was a huge strength for me. And the other one might say, yeah, I really need to work on that backhand down the line.
Right.
And they played the exact same match, you know. So there's that. The only problem for me with that is that it relies on the person actually being able to be somewhat objective and say, yeah,
that's
you know what, my backhand wasn't so great down the line. And actually keep some kind of record of how that point outcome happened during the match, which is hard to do, you know.
But, I think it's really hard. I think it's even harder for the pros. The pros complain to me all the time, like, they do exactly what you just said, where they think they did something great and everyone else thinks they did terrible.
That's just people at every level.
I think as your level is sort of lower, you're less likely to kind of get away with shots and you're more likely to just flat out make errors. So if you're hitting lots of balls out, it tends to be, I think, more obvious for people that, you know, they're making a mistake.
Well, yeah, but again, like, you'd just be amazed now if people will make the mistake over and over again and still think it's their best shot, you know? That's really the struggle. But regardless, folks, we'd love to hear what you have to say about it or any questions that you might have regarding statistics or pretty much anything else, even if it's an idea for a future podcast topic that you would like to hear us argue about. We'd love to hear it from you. So you can reach me at glenn@tacticaltennis.com.
I'm Jacob at tacticaltennis.com.
And I hope you all have a great afternoon, morning, evening, and we'll see you next time.
Have a good one.